Morning all.
Morning.
Did you hear the news this morning? No? I heard there was a big line of Presbyterians outside the Apple store this morning. Did you not hear that? They all smashed their phones last night apparently and then woke up with lots of regret this morning. Well, we'd like to begin reading again in Daniel. We read some of that last night, and I want to read the rest of that chapter. Daniel chapter 1, you'll remember we were saying that although we are not living in a physical Babylon, a physical exile, we are living in many ways in a digital Babylon, and using Daniel as an example of how to not just survive but thrive in digital Babylon. We saw how Daniel refused to contaminate himself and asked to be tested and see whether the divine diet, the Daniel diet, was better than the Babylonian diet. And then in chapter 1 and verse 15, we read, "And at the end of 10 days, their features appeared better and fatter in flesh than all the young men who ate the portion of the king's delicacies. Thus the steward took away their portion of delicacies and the wine that they were to drink and gave them vegetables. As for these four young men, God gave them knowledge and skill in all literature and wisdom. And Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. Now, at the end of the days when the king had said that they should be brought in, the chief of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar. Then the king interviewed them, and among them all, none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore, they served before the king. And in all matters of wisdom and understanding about which the king examined them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and astrologers who were in all his realm. Thus Daniel continued until the first year of King Cyrus." I find that just such an encouraging passage. You know, it's not just that they barely survived. They were 10 times better, healthier, wiser, more helpful, more useful, and excelled in this hostile culture through their decision to follow the divine diet rather than the Babylon diet. I really believe that's a possibility for us and our children. And although it feels in prospect and in the early days of this kind of diet, this is impossible. Kids are going to go crazy. We're going to, you know, smash relationships. Yes, there can be difficulty in the early days, but the payoff in the long run, I think, should hugely encourage us. So, last night, we began looking at digital dangers, and we ran through a number of these dangers, really trying to warn against the toxicity of digital technology. And today we want to begin to look at how do we detox, given that not just our children, but many of us are intoxicated digitally. How do we begin to separate ourselves from that diet and begin to consume a more healthy, balanced diet? So this talk, I want to look at that idea of digital detox, and then in the next one, a digital diet. But maybe first of all, I want to define, first of all, what is an addiction? What is an addiction? Well, here's a standard definition. It's a condition that results when a person ingests a substance or engages in an activity that can be pleasurable, but the continued use of which becomes compulsive and interferes with ordinary life responsibilities, such as work, relationships, or health. I think when you hear something like that, you see how this really does fit under the category of addiction. But I want to try and figure out, I want to ask some questions that will help us decide the nature and the extent of our digital addiction. This is a vital step towards any kind of detox. So last night when we were looking, okay, here are some really general dangers out there in this digital culture. Now we want to come a bit closer and say, well, what about you? What about me? What about our children? And when we're looking at this question, we're really looking at two main questions. The first one concerns quantity, and the second one concerns quality. Quantity and quality. Under quantity, there are two questions. I was just speaking in very general terms just now. Number one, how many hours a day do I spend on my devices? Plural. That includes them all. Phones, iPads, laptops, desktops, video game consoles, etc. Doing this, you want to exclude vocational time spent on devices. Or maybe I should put another little word in there. You want to exclude necessary vocational time spent on these devices. Because, you know, many people will say, well, you know, I'm doing my work, whether it's 3 a.m. or, you know, last thing at night. The big question, though, is it necessary vocational time? So how many hours a day and how many times a day do I use my devices? So you might not be spending 10 hours a day on digital technology, but you may be ruining your day, as well as many other things, by checking into Facebook, Instagram, email, Twitter multiple times a day. You maybe put all these together and it might only amount up to an hour or two, but the average time an American checks into their phone is about 45 times a day. A teen, it's 70 times. And these are just averages. Some of us are way over that as well. So these are the two questions in general we want to ask about quantity, how many hours, and how many times. But then there's a second question, and that is quality. How useful, how valuable, how productive, how healthy is the time that I'm spending on these devices? So this isn't just a question about, is this activity moral or immoral? Even if everything we're doing is moral, it may not be helpful. It may not be useful. It may not be productive. So you want to ask that moral, immoral question, but also wise, foolish, important or trivial, valuable or worthless. We want to look at the quality of our digital use, our digital technology use. Before I go through the digital detox questionnaire, though, just bear these questions in mind, quantity and quality, as I quickly click through again the areas that we looked at last night to remind us of how comprehensive a problem this is. Because I think if we can get a grasp of how massive, how wide, how long, how deep this problem is, then again, our approach to it is going to be all the more serious. So remember we said it kills our brains, it kills our concentration, it kills our memory, it kills our creativity, stroke problem-solving abilities, kills our sleep, kills our identity, kills our mental health, kills our modeling, mentoring, kills our family, friend, relationships, kills our privacy, kills our time management, efficiency, kills our self-control, kills our purity, kills our downtime, kills our finances, kills our very life in the case of, say, texting and driving, kills our spirituality, it kills our meditation, kills our prayer, It kills our churches. So when we see how deadly this is, we really want to deal honestly with ourselves and our children in asking these questions. Given all that this stuff can do, what is the quantity you're consuming and what is the quality that you're consuming? And to do that, I want to introduce you to this questionnaire that you have in front of you. I call it a digital detox questionnaire. And what this tries to do is take these two major categories, quantity and quality, and then begin to look at specific areas of life. Because it's really easy for us. Even last night, you can see all that generalized warning, say, yeah, that's bad, that's bad, that's bad, that's bad. And then you can hear this quantity and quality, yeah, that's bad and that's bad. But what about you? And what about me? And how do we help our children beyond sort of vague generalities? You know, this is really bad for you and things like that. You know, we've got to get down to concrete, practical details. Doing this kind of exercise, going through these questions, you want to do this sort of on a daily basis for a week. Maybe, you know, copy it off a few, seven times, and then do it every day. And then maybe once a week for a few weeks, and then maybe once a month. We're not going to break our habits overnight. We're probably more likely going to wean ourselves gradually. But what I have found in doing this myself, doing this with others, doing this with children, is that even the very exercise, even the fact of you know you're going to have to answer these questions last thing at night before you go to bed, has its own effect. It just begins to put that question in your mind before you log in, before you, start surfing. You know, this is going to be another number one, and this is the second, or the third, or the fourth, or, just the very fact of bringing it to your consciousness, to the front of your consciousness, has its own restricting, hindering, slowing down effect. And the idea is that we don't need this questionnaire eventually. It just becomes part of our psyche. And I think what you'll see as well as we do this questionnaire is that this is not about, cold turkey. That isn't going to work. It's impossible in our day. We cannot survive even by just breaking off all contact with technology. This is about trying to make it manageable, trying to have self-control rather than be under the control of it, trying to get it to a much better place and proportion in our lives. And again, I think that's a lot more reasonable and doable when we're dealing with our children, to try and take a more graduated approach and tailor it as well to the individual, the individuality of each child. So what we have here, first of all, just two definitions: digital media, what that includes, and check-in is really any use of digital media, but especially referring to checking texts, emails, and social media. And the idea here is, as you go through these questions, that you write down your points in the white boxes, and then add them all up, and the lower your score, the better. And the aim is to try and gradually reduce your score over a period of time. So let me just explain some of these questions. Number one, how many times did I check in today? Now, you can get apps to help you track that. So more technology. That will tell you how many times you check in, maybe even some of them how long you check in for. I'll talk a little bit about that in the next talk. But you can see there, 0 to 3 times, you're good. 0 points. You're winning when you're at zero. 40 plus times, you're near 20 points. Number two, for how many minutes did I use digital media today? So you see, we're measuring these two things. How many times did I check in and how long did I check in for? And it's good just to have, you know, something beside you, just noting it down as you go along, because we all lie to ourselves about this. Every single survey that's been done shows that people underestimate how many times they check in and how long they're on for. There's something about being on the internet that just time multiplies. It runs away from you. Number three, how many times did notifications interrupt me? Meaning beeps, buzzes, banners, vibrations. Again, just as much as you possibly can, you want to silence all of these. You know, unless you're a doctor on call or whatever, there is generally speaking virtually no need for us all to be buzzed and beeped throughout the day by every person that decides to send us a text or an email or a like or whatever. That's, I think, step one in a digital detox. Get the notifications turned off. Now, it's not that, you know, you never look at it all day, not at all, but this is about you taking control so that your phone is not in control, your device is not in control, your laptop is not in control, but you are in control. You're not responding to it. You're controlling it. You're putting it in the right place so that you can do quality work, or you can just have space and quiet in your life without this constant interruption. So how many times notification interrupt me? For myself, I turn off all email. I turn my phone to silent. I don't have social media open, and I don't have any notifications from text during certain hours of my day. And my wife knows what these hours are. It's usually from about 7 in the morning till about midday. Now, everyone's work is different, but I need that 5, 6, 7 hours a day of total silence to do my work. And it also means I get a lot of work done, and I get home earlier to see my wife. But in the afternoon, I turn on my notifications for texts. I have my email open 2 or 3 times in the afternoon. But it's really just trying to get quiet, get peace, get focused, get concentrated, and to shut out all the trivialities that are interrupting our daily lives. And people will get used to it as well. People say, oh, you didn't reply to my text within 2 minutes. No, I know, because here's what I'm doing now. And, you know, you have to explain. You have to communicate. You can't just become a hermit and, you know, people misinterpret what you're doing. Number four, how successful was I at batching responses and replies? So instead of as soon as you get a Facebook message, as soon as you get a text, as soon as you get whatever, email, that you're replying, these things are all closed down, and 2, 3, 4, 5 times a day, you go and you process it all. Again, a lot will depend on your work, but even the people I've spoken to about this whose lives involve like email at the very center of their lives, you know, maybe that's their job, they too have been able to take radical steps to do it in a much more batched form. Again, talking to their boss, talking to their colleagues, saying, look, if I'm ever going to get these reports done, if I'm ever going to get these training manuals written, I need to get email done first thing in the morning, just before lunch, and last thing in the day, and in between times, I'm doing deep work. You know, things like that. Everyone can do more than they are doing. A Christian leader came to me earlier this year. He was just in a terrible mess with depression and things like that. And the culture of the organization he was leading was just one of constant communication. And he was just being flooded with communications all day, every day, and couldn't see a way out of it. Well, what you had to do was change the culture of that whole office, that whole organization, and everyone sign on. And now there's peace and there's calm and there's quality long-term work being done. And people are much more disciplined in the way that they are using email and the way that they are batching things. And it's been shown, if you have, say you get 60 emails a day or even 10, whatever it is, the amount of time you spend on it when you batch it rather than doing it all throughout the day is cut by at least 50%. So again, it's about increasing time available for other more important things. How many times did I choose to use my device while standing in line at a traffic stop or in a bathroom stop? Again, this is about trying to free up these 30-second blocks of time for either peace or prayer. Again, Desiring God's survey of 8,000 Christians found that over 70% of them check their phone in line, in the bathroom stops, and at traffic stops. Before our devices, these were times that we used for nothing, or that we would just pray, or that we might even talk to the person beside us in line. And again, okay, this might not mean you never do that, but even if you can cut it by 50% and you bring God into your day in these little 30-second slots, three or four times a day more than you're doing, you're making progress spiritually, and so will our children as well. I've noticed this when I'm with my kids. If we're not using our phones, our devices, watching a game or in the car, and we stop the game, you know, goes to commercials, or we stop at a traffic stop, and I reach for my phone, they all do too. So again, it's about what are we modeling, what habit are we forming in them? Number six, did I use my device before my morning devotions? To me, this is perhaps the most critical area where we can make most spiritual progress. If the first thing you let into that blank mind first thing in the morning is the world, the news, email, tweets, Facebook, you've already written on that fresh blank sheet of mind so much stuff that you then go and try and read your Bible and pray, it's either not going to get through, or it's just going to bounce off, or you're not going to be able to concentrate. Again, we think of our children here. These first moments of the day are the most impressionable moments. All the research shows that that's when our brains are most sensitive, most receptive, and what goes in there lasts longest in impressions. And therefore, to use that to just let in all the rubbish of the day instead of letting in the Word of God and letting in the Lord Himself via prayer and communion, it's such a loss, such a waste of time. Our spirituality is just being destroyed. And part of the problem is we're using phones for alarm clocks, and therefore, you know, the first thing you touch in the morning is your phone, and it's just so easy to pick it up and start using it. Kids are 70% of kids who wake up in the night to go to the bathroom or something check their phones through the night as well. And how do we get away from that? To me, for myself, the only way I can get away from it is go back to an ordinary alarm clock, leave the phone in another room, and make sure it's not on the way I wind my way through my home in order to get to my Bible in the morning, or else I'll pick it up on the way. And when I do my devotions, and I think, again, we want to train our kids in this, make sure that phone is not even within sight, never mind reach, because even if you can see it, it's tempting you, it's pulling you, it's drawing you away. It's more entertaining, it's more enjoyable than reading the Word of God, sadly, or else we wouldn't do it. So, did I use my device before my morning devotions? You answer yes, then 10 points down. Did I let my digital media interrupt my devotions? So again, this is one of the reasons we do not want to be using digital devices for our Bible reading in the morning, because the likelihood of a notification coming in or us succumbing to the temptation to quickly check over here, there, it's just too high. We won't win that battle. Far better to just get back to old technology, printed page, and keep these devices out of reach and out of sight, even just for that 10, 15 minutes or so. It's not asking too much, is it? We're not talking about 2 hours. Just even, you know, for our children, I mean, if they can do 10 minutes of private devotions in the morning, this is good. Number 8, did I check in last thing at night instead of reading and praying? Again, the research shows that what we let into our minds first thing in the morning and last thing at night, these are prime times for leaving memories in our brains. And therefore, if we are, you know, using these last minutes in email and internet and so on, again, that's what's there overnight, rather than something like even reading a verse or just reading a few paragraphs of a good book with our husband or wife or something like that. Did I check in during the night? You answer yes, you get 10 points down. And it's interesting, when I was teaching at Westminster Seminary recently, I was going through this with some of my students, and there was a youth pastor there, and he was kind of nodding all the way through, and then eventually I saw him sort of shaking his head and said, well, what's going on? And he said, I think you need to, with my kids, you'd need to multiply these points by 10. I said, seriously? Yeah, he said, seriously. So I'm probably outdated myself. Number 10, did I check in while with family and friends, i.e. at the supper table or with friends? Did I check in while at a meeting, listening to a lecture or in class? Again, we're just trying to train ourselves and others to be present, to be attentive. And, you know, students think they can do this without people knowing. If anyone who's a teacher here, you know the signs. You can tell. You know, when you see smiles on their faces, you think, I never said anything funny there. You know, you know what they're doing. There's just a look. So much so that actually at the beginning of last fall semester, so a year ago, I banned all devices from my classes. I'd spent 9 years teaching, and I saw it getting worse and worse and worse. And it was really depressing. I don't think I'm a totally boring teacher. And it's, you know, most students would say like practical theology is like more interesting maybe than some of the other subjects. And so eventually I was reading the research as well about the advantages of tech-free classrooms, the score students were getting in various places. I thought, right, I'm doing it, I'm going for it. And I tried again to explain to the students. I showed them 5 or 6 pieces of research. I also said to them, look, I'm going to provide you with notes, or, you know, most of the notes are in the handout, so that you're not like just spending the whole time smoke coming off your pencils. And it was, what a transformation came over our classes. What was really bugging me over the years was no one ever asked a question. Like, you know, you're dealing with just massive issues and there's no questions. Come on, guys. Once we put the tech away, the whole class session sometimes was devoted to Q&A. The minds were engaged. They were thinking. They were responding. They were processing. They weren't just saying, okay, I'll, you know, do that for the exam or whatever. No, they were present. They were engaged. They were involved. They were really interacting. There was so much teaching going on, student to student as well, in ways that never had before. And looking at the student reviews, I was really terrified of that last December after the first semester. I'm thinking, I'm going to get sacked here. Only one student out of all the students complained, and all the rest were totally fine with it. Some were neutral. Most of them felt it was a really positive experience. And, you know, as I was talking to a teacher earlier today, technology in the classroom seems to make education more enjoyable. You know, screens and stuff, it is nice stuff. It's far more sort of enjoyable than just an ordinary book or photocopied sheets. It's more appealing. It stimulates more senses. And of course, there's distraction there too. But though it's more enjoyable, it's not more educational. And we might have a short-term sense of, hey, kids are more engaged. They're not. They're engaged in other things. And enjoyment is not to be the measure of education. Short-term enjoyment, at least. Did I use my device while exercising or walking? You know how it is now. You see, you know, everyone's out there in the gym or jogging and all the earbuds are in. It's not enough for us to do one thing. We've got to do two things at the same time. And again, we're just occupying space. We're not giving our brains downtime. We're not giving our souls connection time. And therefore, you know, just doing these basic things like walking, exercising, these are ripe times for brain healing, soul connecting. Number 13, did I use two devices at the same time? Number 14, how many times did I manage to spend an hour without checking in? Maybe that's just a very realistic aim to begin with. Can I go an hour? Number 15, did I take a digital Sabbath this week? In other words, set aside the Lord's Day to fast from social media, the internet, email. It might not be the Lord's Day you do. I think it's the best day to do it. But it's interesting, even the tech titans are recommending this, that you take a digital Sabbath. And some companies, in Europe at least, are shutting down their servers one day a week to make sure their employees have one day free of email. And for me, this involves simply on a Sunday, not checking email, not checking social media, not going on the internet for news. I've changed that slightly recently because I was sort of caught out, you know, ended up at church and went through a service, and then somebody said to me, did you not hear about some shooting or terrorist or volcano, I can't remember what it was. I thought, okay, as a pastor, I probably should check just before I go out, just check the headlines, just to make sure I don't miss a big issue for prayer. But I found my Sabbaths, my Lord's days, just totally transformed by this. It's not just I get a breather myself, but just spiritually, just putting that distance between myself and the ordinary daily things of life via the internet, email. It just creates such a positive environment. And again, for our children, I think we can help them with this. We'll talk about that in the next session. But to try and help them, even just where we put their devices on one day a week, talk to them about the benefits of it. How many minutes did I spend in each of the following categories? So here we're beginning to look at quality. And here I have three levels of quality. Level one, digital activity. So these are healthy, these are profitable activities. They educate us, they edify us. So maybe good news sites, we need to keep in touch. Christian blogs, hobby interests, health and finance. The number of minutes you spend on that, multiply by one. Okay. Then level two, digital activities, neither moral nor immoral, but often trivial and pointless. So social media, such as Facebook, Twitter, Snapchat, sports channels, blogs, whatever, might be different for you. Again, not saying don't, but be aware you're paying a price when you are in these activities. You're accumulating 3 points for every minute that you spend in them. And then level three digital activities, so these are immoral and sinful activities, such as porn, gambling, watching violence, and so on. Number 17, how many times did I post about myself on social media today? This is where this youth pastor started shaking his head. He said, your figures are way too low. How many critical, snarky, sarcastic, mocking comments did you leave on social media and blogs? How much time did you spend on digital media when you were being paid to work? So again, here we're not talking about necessary work in the digital realm, but what you are doing when you're meant to be doing that. 20, how late into the evening did you use digital media? Again, the research is showing that it's not just digital media delays sleep, it shallows it so that you don't go into the deepest realms of restful, restorative sleep, and also sleep is much more interrupted. It's not something you're maybe aware of, like you're not conscious, I'm waking up all the time through the night, and you're not conscious that you're not going into these deepest realms of restorative sleep, but you wire somebody up to measure these things objectively, and you get one group to use social media 2 hours before and then shut down, 1 hour before sleep, shut down, or just they go to sleep and shut down, and the differences are massive. And again, this is taking a huge toll on us, gradually, slowly wearing us down. So I took a 2 hour break from digital media before bed, you get 0 points, and that's good. 1 hour break, 5 points, 2 hour, so on. Number 21, did using digital media delay my regular bedtime? It's a sort of similar question. How accurately do your social media accounts reflect your actual life? Do the people who know you best in real life recognize you on Facebook, Instagram, and so on? That's a question that only another person can answer for you. 23, how would I rate my work, business, school-related use of email and other messaging systems? So we all recognize these are necessary parts of many of our callings, but am I being efficient? Am I being effective? Am I being honest? And so on. How many times did I do work after hours? Again, a lot of people are doing this, and there's a sense that they feel they need to, and yet in the vast majority of cases, it is not necessary. Add 20 points for every time you check messages while driving. It's illegal in Michigan. Don't know what it is here. Deduct 10 points for every 30 minutes spent reading a real book. So this is good. You've accumulated a lot of points. How do I get this back? I'm sinking here. Go and read a real book. Every 30 minutes, you get an extra 10 points, okay? Again, the amount of understanding, recall, and rest that results from reading a real book as opposed to a digital book, the differences are really significant. Deduct 5 points for every time you pray instead of check in. Okay, so all these 30-second times during the day, here's again a way to get your points down. 28, deduct 5 points for every time you choose to start a conversation instead of check-in. So I'm giving you a lot of grace here, okay? You can really earn your way back into my favor here. How many selfies did you take today? Okay, so at the bottom, you've got a total score then, right? And again, here's where my youth pastor friend kind of shaking his head. 100 plus, you're passed out drunk on data. 60 plus, you're drunk and disorderly, but you're not passed out. 0 to 30, you're sober and almost teetotal. And I've just found this a very convicting tool for myself. I should do this again, I'm thinking as I go through it. And my students have found it helpful. Other people I've used it with in counseling have found it helpful. I would recommend it as a basis for discussion amongst your children. It's lengthy. Maybe you can shorten it. You know, just edit it accordingly. I don't care. Use my words. It's not copyrighted or anything. Just take it and run with it and try. And again, the aim is to get to an objective analysis of where you and your children are. So we're not in the vague generalities of, you know, I think you're using this too much. No, I'm not using it too much. Well, here's some way of getting some way of objectively measuring this. And the idea is, as I say here, is it on there? Yeah. Okay, you end up with this high score. That's bad, but it's okay. The aim is reduction. Reduction, reduction. It's not elimination, it's, okay, let's try and knock this back 20 points this week or today. And I think we need to just keep going back to this. I don't think many of us, if any of us, will ever win this battle in a way that we won't ever have to fight it again in this world. And it's something we need to keep in front of our children at all times. And show that you yourself are doing it. I think that's the key point here. The kids see us and they think, oh, well, you're not doing it. No, but I'm your dad. I'm your mom. Well, I don't think that's good enough here. We have to put in front of them a good example. I'll just finish with this. Ross Douthat, he's a commentator in the New York Times, probably about the most conservative you'll find there. And he wrote this article called The Real Threat to the Human Future. And he said, what do you think it is? Globalization, population growth, terrorism, inequality? No, he said, none of these. He said, it's the internet. And he highlights how our day-to-day, minute-to-minute existence is dominated by a compulsion to check email and Twitter and Facebook and Instagram with a frequency that bears no relationship to any communicative need. He says, used within reasonable limits, these are all graces, he calls them. He's a Roman Catholic. But he says, these apps, these devices are built to addict us, to madden us, to distract us, to arouse us and deceive us. We primp and perform for them as a lover. We surrender our privacy to their demands. We wait on tender hooks for every like. The smartphone is in the saddle and it rides mankind. He's calling for a digital revolution, not just a resistance, but a revolution to take back control. He says, only a movement can save us from the tyrant in our pocket. Here are some of the measures he advocates, and we'll unpack some of these in the next session. Number one, create more spaces in which internet use is illegal, discouraged, or taboo. Toughen laws against cell phone use in cars. Keep computers out of college lecture halls. Put special phone boxes in restaurants where patrons would be expected to deposit their devices. Confiscate smartphones being used in museums, libraries, cathedrals. Create corporate norms that strongly discourage checking email in a meeting. Get computers, all of them, out of elementary schools and let kids learn from books. The age of consent should be 16, not 13, for Facebook. Kids under 16 shouldn't be allowed on gaming networks. High school students shouldn't bring smartphones to school. Kids under 13 shouldn't have them at all. Voice-only plans available for minors. Again, there's no Christian basis for this really, but it's just practical, pragmatic, common sense advice that people are beginning to think about and begin to promote and argue for. And it would be wonderful if for once the church wasn't behind the curve on this. And we have far more motivation to detox than the world does, because we're not just concerned about relationships. We're not just concerned about our bodies and our brains. We're not just concerned about emotions. We're concerned about the soul, about the eternal welfare of our children. So I hope this little questionnaire can help you begin this process of detoxification and encourage your children along similar lines as well. And in the next talk, we'll begin to talk about, okay, what does this look like going forward? If we're separating by detox, what does a diet look like? Thank you for hearing me on this and interacting with it. I've had a lot of good questions privately as well. Made me think a bit more. I've got more work to do on this. And yeah, just probably within the next few months, I'll put this material on my blog in video form. We have a video unit at our seminary, and I'll probably do a few sessions there, filming to camera, incorporating the slides. So You can maybe, if you wanted to use it in schools or with your kids or whatever, hopefully it'll be there within a few months. Maybe Josh, you can look out for that and tell people, I don't know. So we've been looking at the dangerous toxicity of digital technology. We've been looking at the requirement of beginning a digital detox. But we also want a digital diet. We want to be able to incorporate digital technology in our lives in a way that will build us up. We want to look at some of the advantages of a well-controlled use of digital technology. Just as, you know, Daniel and his friends took a different, a less exciting, a less enjoyable diet, and yet the result was, with God's blessing, they prospered. I believe if we have faith in this area, and it's an exercise of faith. I mean, which one of us thinks of talking to our kids or our spouse about this without fear, if not terror, about the consequences? But, you know, it's like every area of life, if this is right, if this is the right thing to do, then we have to exercise faith as we do so. And just refer back to this book again, Reset Your Child's Brain, a 4-week plan to end meltdowns, raise grades, and boost social skills by reversing the effects of electronic screen time. It's written by a doctor, Dr. Dunkley, and she was, I think she's a psychologist, if I recall. She was really alarmed at the surge of diagnoses of ADHD, autism, Asperger's, anxiety, all that spectrum amongst really young kids. And, you know, she'd been involved in treating kids suffering in this way for many years with all the good therapies that are available and some medications too. But this surge, she said, was being met immediately by the same treatments, like just more of this therapy, especially more medications. And she felt, we've got to try and understand this, you know, before just throwing more pills at it. What's going on here? And the more she looked at it, the more she came to the conclusion that, not of course with all these kids, but in this surge, that it coincided with the widespread use of screens amongst under 10s. And she devised this experiment to withdraw kids from screens. And there was a 1 week of extreme pain with the children and the parents. But within 2 weeks, there was peace. Within 3 weeks, the child was beginning to go back to developmental norms, and within 4 weeks, some of these kids were actually cured. Again, this is not true of all kids with this, but those kids who have ended up in this, not so much by genetics, but more by overdose, can have that reverse. And I think all of our kids are suffering to one degree, not to that degree, but to some degree, and therefore the principles in this book are very applicable in putting digital technology in a better place in our children's lives. So how do we move towards a Daniel diet in a digital Babylon that we're occupying? How do we train our children towards this? Well, one of the answers that people have is no technology. Okay, this is, there's so much harm, there's so much danger, so toxic, let's just ban it all, get rid of it all, smash it all to pieces, and it just doesn't work. Now, not many people take this route, but some people do. I think we've all been tempted to. And my kids still remind me of the day when I think my two boys were about 4 and 5, and I took the television out the living room with them into the car, drove down the road, and threw it in a dumpster. They'll never forget it. And it was just like, I think it was Teletubbies or something. I just had enough of the exposure and the effect that just so much time in front of the TV was having on them. And it wasn't long. But anyway, yeah. But it creeps in other ways, doesn't it? It's understandable. It's, in some ways, it's admirable. I hear of parents doing this, and I think, well, you know, it's an admirable aim, but it's impossible to enforce because the stuff is so pervasive. You just cannot get away from it. And children find ways to get it. And then they're getting it and they're using it without any supervision, without any training, without any accountability. So no technology really is just, it's just not going to work, tempting though it may be. So then another response is more technology in the sense of, okay, that's bad technology, let's get some good technology in here to try and get the bad stuff under control. So there's various I thought I had some graphics there, but I know where that is. It's in my internet here. So things like Challies. He has this is Tim Challies' blog site. He has what's called the porn-free family plan that incorporates a number of pieces of technology, hardware and software and online, to try and protect one's family, especially from pornography. And again, just recommend you read that. It's very step-by-step. And it incorporates, you know, discussion with family, communication, explanation, review, just a very practical way of incorporating what he's found to be the best pieces of hardware and software to try and protect one's family. One of the devices that he recommends is this one called Circle. It's about $100, and that's part of his porn-free family plan. Very helpful. There's Covenant Eyes, accountability software that all my children have. I have it. My wife has it. My report goes to my wife. My wife's report comes to me. My kids' reports come to me. This is not foolproof. Right? There are ways around this. Kids can find ways around it. If I wanted, I could probably find ways around it. But it's just, again, just another line of defense, not impregnable. But it's only $15 a month and can save your children and yourself from years of trouble in the long run. It's like a vaccination. It's like a shot. It's trying to stop viruses coming in. They're not foolproof, but worthwhile pursuing. And then there's Freedom, which is an app you can put on your phone that will count the number of times you check in, but it will also help you to block certain sites for certain times. So I have that on my laptop. I have it on my phone. Actually, it's not on my phone just now for another reason, but you can combine these together and decide, okay, during the hours of, say, 8 in the morning and 12 midday, I cannot access any Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or whatever. Name the ones that you permit or the ones that you forbid. You set time limits on it. Again, this is a bit trial and error. You make some estimates. You see what works. See how your children squeal. And then you might need to make some adjustments. But again, just a helpful app to have in your arsenal. And there's many other apps and pieces of software and hardware that you can find. Some of them will be referred to in Challies' article. But you're never going to get enough technology to beat the bad stuff. You're just not going to do it. Teens especially are going to find ways around it. They are more savvy than we are. I'm not saying don't do it. I'm saying do it. But this is not the end of the story. This is not the be-all and end-all. I used to think it was. It's not. The most we can do is slow it down. The most we can do is make it harder. The most we can do is put sort of blocks in the way that even if they're going to go over, they have to do it against their conscience. And you hope that, you know, at least at times it's going to have an effect. Also, you can, like Charlie's there, have a totally secure home. You've got it defended from every angle. But as soon as they walk out the door, they have friends. And they have access to public computers. And they can get another device. My daughter was telling me the other day, this family, she knows, the guy in the family has been banned from a phone, and he has four other devices that his parents know nothing about, right? So it's not the only solution. Also, it tends towards legalism, tends to undermine relationships by creating a culture of suspicion all the time. Again, I'm not saying don't do this, but it's got to be couched within a broader, more healthy relational framework, so it's not a game of cat and mouse or detective and criminal. And also, you know, one of the things is we're trying to train and prepare our children for independent use of the internet eventually. Although, personally, I don't think any of us should be independent in this world. I think every husband and wife should be accountable to one another in one way or another. So, no technology, it's not going to work. More technology will work to a certain extent. What we actually need is more theology. That might seem a really strange place to go here, but I really believe the longer I've struggled with this myself, with my own family, with others in counseling, pastorally, the more convinced I've become that the ultimate answer is not more technology, but more theology. If we want a deep and a lasting spiritual solution, we need to teach and learn deep, lasting spiritual truths. Sound digital theology is the answer to digital technology. The oldest truths are the answer to the newest challenges. And more Trinity is more effective in the long run than more technology. How can you say that? Well, let me just give you some truths that I believe should be very much kept in front of ourselves and our children in this training process. Number one, God is all-knowing. Let's keep that always in front of our kids. He's omniscient. He's omnipresent. He knows everything and he is everywhere. We cannot know everything about our kids. We cannot be everywhere with our kids. And if we're relying on our knowledge and our supervision, we're leaving huge gaps open for the enemy. But if we can build into our kids from the earliest age and continually through their upbringing that God is present and knows everything, wherever they are, whatever they're doing, it can have a restraining effect at least. We cannot be everywhere. We cannot know everything, but God can and God does. And he's taking a daily report. You know, God knows every single website we visit, every app we use, every photograph we see, every comment we leave. And I believe the more that we remind ourselves and our kids of that, again, we're laying down obstacles and barriers to misuse that are far more effective in the long run than technology or banning it. And I think it's not just in a judgmental sense, but also to encourage our children that God takes pleasure in us when we use his gifts in ways that please him. It's not just that God stands there ready to hammer us when we transgress. He smiles when we do good and we use good things for good purposes, that God can actually take pleasure in our use of the internet, in the use of his good gift of digital technology. And again, we want to encourage our children to live to please God, to, as it were, put a smile on his face. It's not just please your parents, it's to please God. God is all-knowing. But God is judge as well. And we have to remind our children of that. He's one day going to call us to account, not just for every idle word, but for every idle click. He is so discerning in his judgment. He knows what is right and wrong, what's wise and foolish, what's helpful and unhelpful. as the judge of all the earth, as the perfect judge. He has perfect discernment. And therefore, again, we want to go to the Lord and say, Lord, I'm lacking in judgment. I'm lacking in discernment. I find it hard to make these distinctions and make these decisions. Lord, you are judge. Help me to be a better judge. Help me to daily discern better. Share with me your judgment of these situations, these websites, this use of technology. But we also want to remind our children, God is Savior. God is Savior. Why is that so important? Well, sometimes guilt stops sin, right? We feel guilty, conscience convicts us, we kind of hesitate to sin again. But I believe more often guilt multiplies sin. How does that work? Well, I'm sure you've gone through this cycle yourselves. You do something wrong, you feel guilty, you feel condemned, and you think, what's the point? What's the point in even trying? I've done it again. Guilt makes us despair. Guilt makes us hopeless. Guilt alienates us from God. It puts distance between ourselves and God so that we want to get away from him, and therefore we're moving away from his help, from his grace, from his presence in our life. It makes sin much easier then, as we're more alienated, we're more distant, we're more out of fellowship. And that's why we and our children need to hear continually about salvation, about grace, about forgiveness, that no matter how many times they have fallen, no matter how deep they and we have fallen, that God is still willing to save, that he's still willing to give grace, he's still willing to wipe the slate clean. There's nothing more motivating to obedience than forgiveness. It's not, well, I've sinned again, I'll get more forgiveness so I can sin again. It's, I've sinned again, I need forgiven so that I do not sin again. As the psalmist said, there's forgiveness with you that you may be feared, so that we may live more carefully and cautiously. And it might seem counterintuitive to emphasize grace as a way of keeping our children from abusing technology, but it's the gospel way. It's like, you know, it's like getting a clean sheet. You know, if you've got a sheet that's got some mud spots on it, a piece of paper with mud spots on it, you're not going to go out of your way to keep it clean. You put on a new outfit, a new soccer uniform or something, it's got dots of mud on it already. You're not really going to go out of your way to keep it clean, but you put on a brand new spotless soccer uniform, it's not got a mark on it. You watch these kids, they don't want a drop on it. And it's the same spiritually. The more we embrace and enjoy the snow white forgiveness of God and help our children to embrace that, I really believe the more cautious they will be in their use of technology. Nothing deters sin like the forgiveness of sin, because only it removes guilt and multiplies love for the forgiver. You know, he who has been forgiven much, the same loves much. And the more we can help our children see how much they've been forgiven, how much they can be forgiven as well, then the more they will not just separate from sin, the more they will embrace the forgiver with their hearts. Again, this is not something that happens in one parent-child conversation or one sermon. This has got to become a lifestyle of bringing grace to our children. God is Savior. God is powerful. Again, just a basic truth. I'm sure every one of us here, when we think of trying to face this demon in our pockets, think, who's sufficient for these things? Who can do this? This is impossible. I've tried, I've failed. My kids, I've tried, I've failed. The forces are too many, they're too mighty. And you're right, they are for us. But greater is he who is with us than he who is in our pocket. With God, all things are possible. And in fact, he loves it when we bring our impossibility to him, because he loves to make the impossible possible. He is powerful. He is all powerful. He can keep our children. He can keep our children safe, can help us release them and entrust them to him as they make their way in the world. He can give them his powerful Holy Spirit to work in the heart and the soul, to give them a love for what is light and true and beautiful. His Spirit is more influential than the spirit of the age. So we could go on through the attributes of God. We could go on through the person and work of Christ, but I've just given you a few ideas to begin to work with. And I think this is key in our training of our children, that we root it not in technology, but in theology. And we root it not in man-centered solutions, but in God-centered solutions. And it might seem naive, you know, really? Theology is going to beat technology? Well, it might seem naive, but I believe it's the way. It's the gospel way, it's God's way, and it's our unbelief, I think, that holds us back from really embracing this as the foundation. It's not the whole solution, but it's the foundation of any lasting solution for ourselves and for our children. More theology, more relationship with God. So it is possible to have more theology in our children, and yet they're not having a relationship with God. They can have their minds filled with truth, and that can help, but we need their souls communing with God. God's three-in-oneness, God's tri-unity, is a relationship to be enjoyed by us. He is relationship in his own essence, in his own being, at his very core. He is relationship. And really what he's doing is he's saying through the gospel, come and enjoy the relationship I have within myself. Come and participate in the most happy, blessed, satisfying relationship there is in the whole universe. We're invited into that Trinity. We're invited into that communion. And again, the more we do that, the more Trinity we have in our lives, the more relationship we have with the three persons of the Godhead, the more that will, if not replace technology, it will regulate our technology use so that our relationship to it is more beneficial and helpful. So really it's saying, you get the most important, powerful relationship in the universe right. You enter into that relationship. You make that relationship the core, the energy of your life. Then your relationship with everything else in life will fall into place. Your relationship in your marriage, with your children, with technology, with everything else. And that's why I mentioned in that last talk, these first minutes of the day are just foundational. They are the secret to this. Meet with God first, not your phone. Meet with God in quiet, no distractions. And meet with God in secret, no sharing. I've found this myself, and talking with others the same. The whole nature of your private devotions change if you enter them with the view of sharing what you read in your daily devotions. Because then you've brought someone else into this relationship, a friend, the world, your Facebook followers or whatever. Even if you discover like the most beautiful nugget of truth in your devotions, I think you should make it a rule, I'm not sharing it. Because that becomes what conditions your relationship from there on in with God. And there's a third person there in the room with you that shouldn't be there. And even if it's for a time, just to get that relationship back on a proper footing, just resolve, this is me and God. Me and God. It's not anyone else. I'm not sharing the contents of this. And get back to just private, secret, in the closet relationship with God. More relationship with God. More relationship with our children. Again, we're moving outwards, as it were, from the Trinity. We're moving now into relationships with one another. Again, the Trinity is our model for this. The Trinity's persons, their relationship is characterized by love, by trust, by openness, and by communication. And that's the pattern for our parenting as well. The healthier relationships we have with our children, the healthier the relationships they will have with technology. Deeper relationships are more effective than detailed rules. Sometimes children resort to technology because there's a vacuum in their lives. They're connecting with an outside world because there's no connection within their own homes. It's not always the case, but sometimes it is. Now, I've come across many different ways that parents try to relate to their children in terms of technology, and I want to just highlight a few of them here. The first one is the ostrich parent. And the ostrich just puts his head in the sand and ignores everything, doesn't want to know what's going on in their child's lives or even in the wider world. They're hoping that if they keep their head buried long enough in the sand, that they'll bring their head up one day and the internet will be gone and all the problems with it, and they won't have had to get involved with it at all. Maybe there's some ostriches here. Then there's Snake Dad. Snake Dad sneaks around trying to slither into his children's lives, trying to catch them red-handed and red-faced, prowling around, creeping up on their teenage son with their iPad, opening the bedroom door unexpectedly. Aha! Snake Mom, she sneaks through her daughter's Facebook pages, sometimes using an alias, trying to find out what's going on, trying to find that deadly secret boyfriend. So this is a kind of more sneaky, furtive, underhand approach. Then there's the lion. This dad, usually, he roars in fury at the slightest infraction of his rules. Sometimes literally smashing the technology, or in my case, throwing it in the dumpster. You've infringed my cell phone use rules, internet rules. I am going to come at you like a furious, savage lion. Then there's the donkeys. They stubbornly refuse to move with the times. No matter how hard their children pull, they will not budge. My children have never had cell phones. They'll never have them. I didn't have one when I was young, and I turned out all right. Well, you can try it. The sheep family, well, yes, there are sheep in this digital jungle. They just do what everyone else is doing. Because, I mean, that must be okay if everyone else is doing it. Yeah? Then there's the giraffes. They look down on everyone else from a very high moral height with an air of superiority. I mean, my children wouldn't do that. You don't know my children. Oh, you don't know your own children. Then there's the cheetah family. They're always out in front. Early adopters of the latest technology. They're keeping pace with the times. They're probably faster than the times, actually. They almost always have Macs. And their one rule is always be first, always be first, always be at the forefront. Now, I think you can see the weaknesses that are obvious in all these approaches. Here's the animal, or the bird, really, that I think you want to try and model yourselves on, and it's the eagle. The eagle. What does the eagle do? It slowly introduces its children to the dangers of flying over a period of time. Actually, I haven't looked at the American eagle in particular, but I know certain eagles do. I just like that picture of that eagle. But many eagles, they are protecting their young, even at the expense of their own lives at times, from all comers as they're in the nest. And then as they gradually grow, their children get to the edge of the nest and they begin to move out. And then they begin practicing flying on the edge of the nest. And then they might take a few steps, and whenever they begin to venture out, Mom Eagle is always underneath them. So that if they start to fall, she swoops down and picks them up. And then if they start flying, and they're flying away, and they're going really well, but then they run out of energy and they start plummeting, Mom swoops down underneath, carries them on her back to the nest, brings them in under her wings. And you can see what's happening here. The eagle is trusting and even pushing out at times, but always with a protective undergirding, always nearby, always close, always there to offer support, to lift up, to carry, to bring back to the nest for healing and strengthening again. Just something like that is closer, I think, to the attitude and relationship that we should have with our children regarding technology, a sort of slow introduction to it, graduated introduction to it, supportive, undergirding, there to shield, there to protect, there to pick up, there to bring back, there to heal, there to encourage, and so on and so forth. More relationship with our children. More boundaries. We need more boundaries. Now, these are usually in a few categories. Number one, time boundaries. So again, just an agreement with your children. How much time is appropriate on a school day, on a weekend day, or in the evenings? Time boundaries. Again, this will vary with the children. It will vary with their ages. Some children are more obsessive and addictive than others, and you have to watch them more carefully. Some you can trust more than others. So you've got to tailor this to your children and your situation. Website boundaries. So again, you start maybe with an app that only allows them onto certain websites. You can list them and you give them liberty within that website or two or three. And then as they show themselves worthy of trust, you can extend the boundaries and increase the boundaries. And then eventually you might get to the point where you have category boundaries for websites. Again, apps can help you with that. Social media boundaries. That's really helping your children seeing what's appropriate to share of family life, their own lives. Again, you're wanting to train them up and not, okay, you've crossed the rule, you're never doing it again, but no, you've crossed the rule. Can we talk about what's gone wrong here? What would be a better use of this media? Work and study boundaries, so what's appropriate use of technology when you're at work, when you're at school, when you're studying. Maybe place boundaries, so you might say at the meal table, that's device-free, that's what we do. Bedroom boundaries, no devices in bedrooms. Maybe a central place for technology, we have done that as a family, so that when they come in the door, the devices go in a certain place. They're not carried with us through the house or into the yard. But we can go and access them as and when we want. Boundaries regarding use in the car. Maybe if you're in a long journey, then again, okay, we can use these devices at such and such hours, but otherwise we're talking or we're observing or we're reading or we're thinking or whatever. And I think in all these boundaries, time, website, social media, work, study, place boundaries, we're looking for clarity. Every child loves clarity, consistency in enforcing them, accountability, and not just sanctions for breaches, but rewards for good use. Again, very important in encouraging our children that we actually make it worth their while. So, and the reward might be more time or more access or other ways of rewarding them. Maybe not with more technology, but maybe, okay, I'll take you out for breakfast or let's go out for a family meal with, you know, a good month at this or whatever. Andy Crouch in the book, The Tech Wise Family, You'll find he has these boundaries: no screens before double digits. That is, no screens until children are 10 plus. Car time is conversation time. 1 hour before bed is screen free. Never alone in the bedroom. These aren't Ten Commandments, you know. They're guidelines. They're conversation starters. So more boundaries, more discernment. We're wanting our kids to develop the ability to make wise decisions themselves instead of being always protected by us. There's a talk online, Discipline in Digital Babylon, by David Kinnaman, and he says, we have to teach our kids cultural discernment. That means we have to build up an inner sense of judgment within them, not simply shield them from everything bad or problematic in the world. And this is really our ultimate aim, isn't it? We want our kids, over time, to be trained in such a way that they have within themselves, not from us, not from technology, but from within themselves, developed this capacity to discern, to distinguish, to see differences, to see darkness, to see light, and to be able to do that in every area of life. It's like the Israelites were trained in clean and unclean using animals, to build in them even a moral and a spiritual discernment. And here's an area too that we can use to help our children grow in discernment. Okay, so Covenant Eyes report comes in and you see what they visited. What are you going to do? No, it's not time for yelling and it's not time for banning. It's time for conversing. It's time for talking. It's time for explaining, questioning. What do you see wrong here? What do you think this leads to, and so on and so forth? That discernment, that's a vital part of a digital diet, building that in our children. And the only way you build discernment is by helping their minds to do that, not imposing it on them all the time. More fasting or unplugging. I believe this is the modern day equivalent of fasting in the Bible. In the Bible, it was from food because that's what took up the majority of time in that world, that culture. It was finding food, catching food, killing food, preparing food, cleaning up after food. Now we go to the supermarket, microwave dinner, in the dishwasher, we're done in 15 minutes. That's fasting from food is not going to release a lot of time for us in the day. But fasting from technology, that's the purpose of fasting, is to release time for a higher and a better purpose. And this is one area where it'd be really easy to release time for higher and better purposes. So you might want to think, to begin with, fasting for 1 hour a day from technology, all technology. Fasting maybe one day a week. I think ideally the Lord's Day. Fasting maybe 1 week a year. The Crouch family, when they go on vacation, they have a tech-free week, if I recall, and then the second week, if they have a second week, they have slots where they agree, okay, in these slots, we'll all do our devices, you know, catch up and whatever, and then they're away again. But in general, it's a fast from technology during that time. Sometimes something more radical is required. And that's where this book might come in, Reset Your Child's Brain, where she is talking about a 4-week fast. And she's discovered a strict electronic fast single-handedly improves mood, focus, sleep, and behavior regardless of the child's diagnosis. 65% of Americans agree that periodically unplugging or taking a digital detox is important for their mental health, but only 28% of Americans actually do so. More fasting. More physicality. More physicality. It's not enough to take devices away or take our kids away from their devices. We've got to give them something to replace it, something better, something healthier, something more fulfilling than online activity. And that might mean activities involving the outdoors, might mean sports, exercise, hunting, fishing, running. It might mean more face-to-face relationships with ourselves or facilitating that with their friends, because the majority of kids are now conducting friendships online via chatting and Snapchatting and texting. In Crouch's case, involved more creativity in their family, like making creative spaces in their homes for kids to use their hands and use their heads to imagine and produce in music and art. Crouch says, the more you entertain children, the more bored they will get. The more bored you make children, the more creative they will get. You might want to match screen time with exercise time. So you say, okay, you want 2 hours in front of the screen? Okay, that means 2 hours of exercise, 2 hours outdoors, or 2 hours of a face-to-face relationship. More physicality itself reduces the desire for technology. More positivity. We've talked about this already, and maybe I'm guilty of it, but there's too much negativity surrounding technology. We mustn't just be Eeyores all the time. Some of the time for sure, but not all of the time. Yes, there are dangers. Yes, there are difficulties. But how about balancing that out? How about recognizing and appreciating the amazing technology that God has enabled people to discover and use, and that he's blessed our generation with? Again, I think this is to just keep continually reminding our children that this is a gift of God, of a good God. And just as, you know, if you gave your kids a gift at Christmas time or for their birthday, and then they went and abused it, they threw it off out the window or something, or they just trod on it, or they used it for something it was not meant to be used for and spoiled it, you'd feel insulted yourself. You'd feel offended. You'd feel it was a reflection of what they thought about you. Again, to train our children to think of that in relation to God. He's given you this out of his goodness, out of his love, out of his kindness. And what are you doing? You're using it in such a way that you're coming under God's frown, God's judgment. Let's use this well. This is a wonderful gift. Look at the access to information we have. Look at the connection to family and friends in other countries. Look at how much more information we have. Look at how much we can influence the political process. Look at how it makes daily life easier with our banking and our productivity. Sharing helpful articles with our children. Sending them good things to read. I'm often surprised at what my children do actually read of what I post online. They won't often admit it, but sometimes it slips out that they are actually reading it. And it's a great opportunity. So more positivity, I think, will help as well. So it's not all negative. Here's a surprising one. Let me explain. More sex. More sex. In this book, Help My Kids Are Viewing Pornography, the author summarizes the seriousness of the porn problem to shake parents out of a false sense of security. But he then goes on to a brief theology of sex with a two-pronged challenge to parents. First, to teach their children the beauty of God's plan for sex. And second, to frank discussions with their children about deviations from God's order. All of this is set in a gospel framework that moves parents and children from shame and despair to faith and hope. The answer to the sex problem, porn, sexting, and so on, is not less talk about sex. It's more talk. It's better talk. It's healthier talk. It's earlier talk. And, I mean, at times it's horrible that we have to talk to younger and younger children about these things. But I'm sure we all remember the impression it made on us the first time we heard about such a thing as sex. And sadly for most of us, it was in the context of dirt and filth and wrongness and immorality. That was the first impression that sex left on us. This was something dirty. This was something forbidden. This was something associated with vile habits. How much better if that first impression be from loving Christian parents, setting this gift of God in a biblical framework, putting it forth as just a wonderful provision of God and all the benefits that flow from it. Let that be the first impression. Let that be the first thoughts that they have of this. Even though we have to do it younger and younger, better that than let others in first. And then we've got a lot of repairing and undoing to do. More education. Again, just highlight these books. I've left them at the front here. You can come and have a look at them. Again, just if you weren't here last night, that's the one I would recommend first, The Tech Wise Family by Andy Crouch. Many good books. We need to educate ourselves. More modeling. The foundation for this is our example. I will often give my phone to my children and I'll say, you can go wherever you want. You can look at my email. You can look at my Facebook. You can open any app. You can have my laptop. Do whatever you want. I'd say it to my wife as well. They've got to know that our life is open, no secrets, and that therefore I can have access to yours as well, right? This is a two-way process. And that might seem, oh, well, I mean, I should have access and they should have no access to mine. Well, you can try that. But I believe the more open and accountable we are to our families, the more they will be to us as well. I'm coming to a conclusion here. More prayer, that's ultimately what we need to do, isn't it? Our children need new hearts. That's the ultimate preservative. Our children are born sinners. They're born dead in trespasses and sins. They're born with a love of darkness, not a love of light. And they're going to seek out darkness rather than light. They're going to be attracted to the dark side of the internet. We've got to face reality. So we've got to pray for them to be born again, to have new hearts, that God will give them a love for the light and a hatred of the darkness. And that comes by prayer. When you see your children using technology or walking out the door with their phones, we should be praying that they would be given a love for light. We can train, we can legislate, we can teach, but above all, we've got to pray that our children would obey, not out of fear of the law, but out of love for Christ and a desire to be Christ-like. Remember how Daniel and his friends thrived in physical Babylon. We've got to believe that's still possible in digital Babylon. But it needs a new diet compared to what most children are consuming. And if we do, why not 10 times healthier, 10 times wiser? Is that not possible? Has God changed? He hasn't. This chapter has been a huge encouragement to me as I've tried to move forward in a number of these areas and maintain it in my family. And remember, that stand that they took in chapter 1 prepared them for even more demanding stands later in their lives, in a lion's den and a fiery furnace. We're training our children in this arena to go out and stand up for what's right and true in even more hostile and more dangerous environments. That's what we should be hoping for and praying for. That we would raise children to be Daniels in digital Babylon.